Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of Kim Jong-un's biggest fan to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. The logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the Gish Gallop.
So the Gish Gallop is a method of debating, really, rather than a kind of... I mean, it is a logical fallacy because it's a bad way of making an argument. But actually, it often incorporates a lot of logical fallacies kind of within it. Because what it is when you present lots and lots of arguments, like we talked about the other week with kettle logic. But the point isn't to confuse people and to give, you know, different defenses of something, but lots of different arguments that are separate and usually quite weakly argued or have very little evidential basis, sometimes completely untrue. But because you do so many of them in a row, it actually is quite difficult to refute. And it's used often in a kind of a debate type context because you usually only have a specific amount of time and it's a lot quicker to say bullshit than it is to refute bullshit, because you can make up any old crap and just say it again and again or say multiple different versions of it. But in order to point out how and why and what the context is for something actually not being true or not being well argued or evidential, that takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
So it means people can't put the same amount of effort into looking at every single thing you say, because it would take way too long. Yeah. And it's actually quite boring to listen to in a debate, to someone actually giving the facts of why every single thing is wrong.
That you just said is wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess the implication of it be it's done at a gallop. It's done at full speed. So it's not the Gish Gallop is delivered at a rapid fire.
Yeah, absolutely. It's often a lot of crazy, stupid things said all in one go, one after the other.
Is Trump good at this, isn't he?
Yeah, Trump is excellent at this, yeah. Our example from Trump in this is not a clip, because this is something which although it is done in often kind of rapid-fire technique, it can happen over a period of time when you're saying lots of stuff. Okay. So it's difficult to explore clips on, really, although I think Mark's got some later on. But this is a New York Times interview that Trump gave, which took about half an hour to do, and they recorded it and they transcribed it, and this was in December of 2017. And Washington Post fact-checked it, and they said he made 24 false or misleading claims during this 30-minute interview. So, obviously, the reporter who was interviewing him couldn't, at the time, say all of the reasons why the things he was saying weren't true.
Yeah.
Washington Post and other fact checkers did afterwards, and they do with Trump's claims. But it does take time to not only say what was wrong with what he said, but also do the research, frankly, and look into exactly what's true and what isn't true and the context of things. Some things are a bit quicker. Like, for example, one of the things he said in the interview was talking about his endorsement of Luther Strange, who was, when Trump endorsed him, doing very poorly in the polls. Yeah. He said, I was for Strange and I bought Strange up 20 points. Just so you understand, when I endorsed him, he was in fifth place. He went way up, almost 20 points. Now, Luther Strange was in a race with two other people. So he literally can't have been in fifth place. And in fact, he lost by a greater margin than he was trailing by when Trump decided to endorse him. So,
so yeah, he did end up in fifth place.
He did very poorly indeed. But yeah, it's that kind of thing is quite easy and quick to point out what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
Some things are a lot more complicated. Like one of the other things he said was, he said, we've spent, as of about a month ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East. He said this a number of times. In fact, he used to say $6 trillion. But what he's doing, and if you want to kind of explain why he's come up with this figure and what it means and the context of it, is that all of the wars in the Middle East from the early 2000s in Iraq and Afghanistan, which technically is in South Asia rather than the Middle East, the wars themselves cost about $1.6 trillion. But Trump is including all of the predicted future spending, such as things like caring for veterans over the next 30 years.
Okay, wow. Yeah.
So it's not true to say, as of about a month ago, we've spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. And the point he's making is, you know, and the Middle East is still terrible. It's not, it hasn't, you know, we spent all this money, we've done all these wars, and it hasn't gotten any better. So we should stop spending money, basically. But we haven't spent that money. We spent a fraction of that money with a recognition that because of the wars, there is going to be ongoing cost for that to the American government. So that's something that takes time to put into context when it's actually really quick to say.
Yeah, and it is exactly. And it carries a lot less impact to say, you know, as of now, we've spent $1.7 trillion and we're committed to a further $5.3 trillion over the next 30 years. People just go, that's not too bad. You know, over the next 30 years, there's nothing. The whole point of doing the Gish Gallop is to command the space, be in charge of all the air, and have so many things that you're saying that they can't be refuted. So the implication is that one of them must be true, or the truth of one of them is carried on to the next and the next and
absolutely.
The next. Because nobody's refuting
it's
them.
It's very much about quantity rather than quality of argument.
Right.
It does leave that possibility open that even if someone tries to refute all of the things you say, if they miss one of the things, then you can basically claim victory because they didn't even address that. So our second example, which is kind of Trump adjacent, as isn't actually Trump, is the leader of Turning Point USA, which is an organization that supports Trump heavily. It's a guy I've mentioned before, Charlie Kirk, who is very, very active on Twitter. So I picked a day from the last couple of weeks. I picked, a week ago today, Thursday the 13th of June, and I looked at all the tweets that Kirk sent on that day. He sent 22 tweets. By my count, he made about 45 claims overall in those tweets, because some of his tweets are just multi-part of the kinds of things that he's claiming. And he does a thing which is often associated with the Gish Gallop, which is the acronym is PRATT, P-R-A-T-T, and it stands for Points Refuted 1,000 Times, which is basically just repeating. He's made up a thing and then says it because it has an impact, and people will go, well, that's not true, and here's why that's not true, and they'll explain it in detail, and it doesn't have any impact. He'll just keep saying it. He'll keep tweeting the same thing because it's quick and it's easy when you've already come up with it to say that same thing again and again. And if you just don't care whether it's true or not, then it doesn't matter. It just adds to the pile of stuff that you're trying to push through. So of those 22 tweets, there's a lot of nonsense on that day. I'm only going to address two of them because of the time it takes to address them. So the first one, he said, can we investigate Adam Schiff for trying to receive compromising material on Trump from a self-declared Russian in a phone call? This was a prank call he fell for. The caller declared himself a Russian transferring compromising information. Why didn't he report to the FBI? Investigate. So Kirk is essentially saying, you know, all this accusation that Trump and his family should have reported to the FBI, any information that they were offered from the Russians. Look at Adam Schiff. He had a call offering compromising information from the Russians. He didn't report it to the FBI, which would be a reasonable point if it was true. But
Right.
Adam Schiff did get a call from Ukrainians, actually, not Russians, or claiming to be in the Ukrainian government and have compromise against Trump, including naked pictures from the hotel where supposedly the P-tape was filmed.
Oh, yeah.
The thing is, before he took the call, Adam Schiff called the FBI. He also invited the Republican majority to participate in the call. He let them know about it and said, look, this is something that someone's contacted us about. Do you want to be in on the call?
Right, before it's even happened. Okay.
They had the call. Yeah. They documented it. They reported what had been said to the FBI. And on the call, there's a transcript, and on the call he said to the people who were offering this material, this is something you should probably send to the FBI. We'll, you know, send it to us and to the FBI, and they'll investigate it.
All right.
Absolutely.
So all the things that he's saying that he should have done, he did do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay.
So that's a thing.
Yeah.
But to find that out, to see, you know, it's easy to just hear, well, oh, you know, Adam Schiff had this thing and he didn't report it. And if you look at only right-wing sources, all you get is the bit where, you know, because the pranksters, the Ukrainian pranksters put this up on YouTube, the recording of the call. So that is the bit
just
you hear.
Get the call.
You don't see what goes on behind the scenes. So one other tweet that Kirk sent on this day says, the legacy of Obama Biden, colon, armed ISIS, sold 20% of US uranium to Russia, destroyed our healthcare system, highest ever food stamp enrollment. The legacy of Donald Trump, ISIS destroyed, peace with Korea, historic economy. So there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
That's one tweet.
Yep.
Probably, you know, it took seconds to send and flips past your timeline before you've really had a chance to take it in properly. But it tells Kirk's followers positive things about Trump, negative things about Obama. So
completely unsubstantiated stuff.
Oh, that's one thing that Kirk is extremely consistent. He does not cite sources. You will very rarely find a link in a Charlie Kirk tweet. He does not try to back up his assertions at all with evidence. And he actively doesn't reply to anything that people say to him about his tweets.
That's the thing, isn't it? It is just an assertion. Yeah. But if you can't, there's almost that, if you repeat it 1,000 times, somebody says, oh, yeah, I've heard that already. Where did I hear that before? Well, you know, it was from him, you know, 999 times
ago.
Part
of the zeitgeist. It's just something that people know about because it's come out. It's in there. So, just to address a couple of the issues in this tweet itself then.
Mm-hmm.
Obama/Biden armed ISIS. So I actually tracked down the report that this comes from, and it is from a group called Conflict Armament Research. They wrote a report in 2017 where they tracked down 40,000 weapons that had been used supposedly by ISIS and figured out where they had come from. They looked at serial numbers. They tracked it back to where the weapons were sourced and had been brought into the country and so on. The US had been arming Syrian rebels in the area, in Syria, so that they could fight against the people who were oppressing them and ISIS. So the Conflict Armament Research report looks at these 40,000 weapons, and they detailed one machine gun, two missile tubes, and about 80 rockets that they said had come originally from the US.
Oh, out of the 40,000.
And those weapons were almost certainly, according to the CAR report, given from the US to the Syrian rebels and then captured in combat on the battlefield by ISIS and then possibly used by ISIS against whoever they were fighting against. So is it fair then to say Obama and Biden armed ISIS? Or is it more accurate just to say that ISIS sometimes grabbed the opponent's weapons and used them as well?
Yeah, and 399,999 automatic weapons didn't come from
the vast majority of the weapons that they had and that they identified came from Russia, China, and Eastern Europe.
Ah, so, okay. So it'd be So it would be fairer to say, in the way that it's unfair to say that they armed ISIS, that China, Russia, and armed them.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Obama,
but it's equally that's equally unfair.
The rebels against ISIS.
Yeah. So, as did most of Europe and the rest.
Moving
of
on the, to the 20% of US uranium that supposedly Obama sold to Russia. Yeah. So this is a Russian nuclear agency. They bought a Canadian mining company in, I think, 2010. Mm-hmm. And the mining company is called Uranium One. They had production rights for mining about 20% of the US uranium capacity for production. Right. So the Russians took over the Canadian mining company. They mm-hmm. bought, in doing that, the rights to mine 20% of US uranium, but not right. to export it. The company was not allowed to export that uranium outside the US. So the uranium stayed in the US. Yeah. Russia didn't get any.
Right.
So, again, not really
they didn't sell.
Selling 20% of US uranium to the Russians at all.
No, so let's assume that he did look at those reports, probably not the source material, but someone's opinion on those. Yeah. So even if he did look at the raw material, there's quite a leap to actually, you know, jump over the mitigating circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, Charlie, I'm sure didn't look at these reports. This is selling 20% of uranium to Russia is a right-wing talking point. Trump has said it multiple times. Mm. It's just, you know, it's one of those things. Kurt will occasionally do a tweet saying something like, this is your daily reminder that Hillary sold 20% of our uranium to Russia. It's just not true. So the highest ever food stamp enrollment. We'll skip straight past Obama destroyed the healthcare system, having put millions of people onto healthcare that they could afford.
Yeah.
Past that.
Because that's because it's just self-evidently not right. How on earth? Some convoluted thinking.
The highest
ever
food stamp enrollment under Obama. That's actually true. And that is because Obama took office in a huge recession. And so by December 2012, food stamp recipients in the US were up to 47.8 million. By November 2016, when Obama left office, they were down to 43.2 million. So he got that number of people off food stamps, and that trend continued, and Trump took credit for it. The point that I'm trying to make basically is this is one tweet. And it's got it's got about eight claims in it. Some of them are self-evidently nonsense, like peace with Korea and Obama destroying the healthcare system. Some of them, you do need to go away and do research. You do need to look stuff up and figure out whether it's true or not before you can just say, okay, yes or no. And that's why this is an effective tactic, is because you can just claim something much more easily than you can provide evidence.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Oh, it's been exciting this week. So I tried to listen to we've had a Tory leadership contest here, and I wanted to listen to that because there was gish galloping going on all over the place, but I really couldn't stand to. So I turned to friend of the podcast, Nigel Farage. He's turned up before, and he not only does he turn up on our podcast often, he turns up on Question Time, this particular program, often. Nigel Farage, he's an expert gish galloper, really. And he's kind of built his entire career on piecing together half-truths and making an implication to suit his own purposes. So this is from 11th of December 2014. So this is before the Brexit vote, when he's the leader of the UK Independence Party, UKIP, UKIP. And his the raison d'etre for that party was to get out of the European Union. Quite all right, because he was an MEP, a member of the European at the time. So he was drawing a wage from the European Parliament, had done for like 25 years, and was literally biting the hand that feeds him. So here he is, stringing together a whole bunch of things, and see if you can work out what the implication is.
Look, if you fly into Gatwick, you'll see lots of green spaces. That is certainly true. However, if you have a country in which the population goes up, as a direct result of immigration. What you find is not a shortage of green fields, if that's where you wanted to build houses. You find a shortage of primary school places. You find a shortage of GP surgeries. You know, we have fewer GPs per head than any other country in Europe today. You find congestion, whether it's on the roads or the London Underground or wherever you go. And what you find is that actually you're constantly playing catch-up, and really the general quality of life for the mass of population has gone down.
So he's quite right at the beginning when he says, if you fly into London, you see green spaces. That certainly is true. And actually, that's the only thing that's true. But even that we have to take his word for. If one imagines the view of England, probably does from the air include a lot of green spaces, because it's quite a green place. Outside of London, there's the what's known as the Green Belt, where there was a deliberate policy not to build anything. So it's got lots of trees and fields and all that stuff. And let's face it, the whole of the country is owned by seven people who tolerate us on the corners of their land. So it's mostly green fields. But then he does that. And I think it's because the question is about building on Green Belt. But he, in true politician style, turns it around to answer to make the point he wants to make, which is basically about immigration. So the UK Independence Party was all about not letting people in because they're a drain on resources, as well as, you know, the European Parliament being a force for evil and blah, 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 take our sovereignty, blah, 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 all that. So what is alarming is that he puts in these completely unsubstantiated facts, like where is the evidence for we have fewer GPs per head than anybody else in Europe? We just made that up. And the other bit about, he says, it's not only that, you also get congestion. So he's playing it. And everybody knows there's too many cars on the road, or rather everyone's experience sitting in a traffic jam. The implication being that there are too many cars on the road because there are too many immigrants in the country, not because the car industry is configured such that everybody needs to buy another car. And also that the traffic jams are brought about. So at this point, there is a exclusion zone in London to cut down the congestion in central London, which mean that those cars have moved further out from London, so there are going to be more of them, so possibly people will experience traffic jams more often and on the underground and all that stuff. So it's what is frightening about this, and we'll hear somebody say that. Oh no, he doesn't say it. But what is frightening about this is it's all very familiar, matey stuff. This is Farage's persona: is the man down a pub with a fag in one hand and a pint in the other, and he'll talk to you like he's like a cab driver, you know, who moans about stuff. Yeah. He's down the pub, and the kind of things that you experience as an ordinary person, and he does the little switcheroo, which is to say, well, you know, well, that's all down to, it's all down to immigrants. And you find yourself agreeing because you've gone along with the gallop. And before you know it, you're at the finish post and he's led you there. So in order to refute this in the self same program, the next person to speak is another friend of our show, Russell Brand. And he says this.
I know a lot of people are frightened in our country. I know a lot of people are feeling afraid and frustrated. And there is a sense that there is a corrupt group in our country using our resources, taking away our jobs, taking away our housing, not paying taxes, exploiting us. And there is an economic elite that this man's party is funded by, that this man comes from background working in the city. Let me tell you something. There was an economic crash and a lot of money was lost. His mates in the city farted. Nigel Farage is pointing at immigrants and the disabled and holding his nose. Immigrants are not causing the economic problems and suffering we're experiencing.
So the thing about this is, here's where I experienced cognitive bias, because Russell Brand, for all his posed persona as much as Farage. So Russell Brand is a kind of a bit of a lounge lizard, a roué. He's another man of the people. You know, he's an ex-drug addict. He's got marvellous teeth, and he's quite funny, and he's popular and accessible. But he's just as much a character as Farage is. And I think he's as guilty of doing a Gish Gallop just as much as Farage is, because he makes the leap from, yes, people are frightened these days, but there is an elite group that's bringing this about. So there's the, we are forced to make that leap. And you think, well, okay, well, where's your evidence for that? And then he says, you know, there was an economic crash, and we know there's an economic crash. And then he makes that into it being Farage and his cronies, i.e. the banking system, who are denying responsibility for it and heaping all the blame onto the, you know, immigrants and the disabled. So my cognitive bias is I find that quite an appealing argument. So and it just in hearing those two, I found his approach on first hearing was the one I agreed with. But then I realised, well, it's just as unsubstantiated as Farage's stuff. And I could see that, in fact, half of the audience applauds Farage and the other half applauds Russell Brand. And that's just how it is. So there are people who agree with one and don't agree with the other. But based on nothing but, I suspect, how they feel in the first place.
Yeah. And neither of them is convincing anyone. It's all rhetoric rather than actual.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. These two oratorical experts are just using the right kinds of words to the right kind of people. So they are playing to their own galleries. Yeah. They're very good at it. The problem is, so Farage, in his latest incarnation as the leader of the Brexit Party, having left UKIP because they got the referendum, UKIP didn't need to exist anymore. It got absorbed pretty much into the Tory Party. Then he realised we haven't left yet, so he started the Brexit Party in order to try and leave again. He was being interviewed on Andrew Marr's show on a Sunday quite recently on the BBC, and he was complaining to Andrew Marr that Andrew Marr was asking him all these questions about, well, so do you still believe that immigrants are to blame for everything? Instead of asking him about the runaway success of his Brexit Party. And that's because the problem with Gish Galloping is people are writing down all this shit that you say, and they will hold you to account for it at some point. That's why you have to do the Pratt move and just keep going and keep going and keep going and keep reiterating these bollocks, and don't let anybody say, so that thing that you said 4 years ago, do you still believe that? That's, you know, because he just does it all the time, so he can't remember what you said. So
yeah, he gets out of it by saying, you know, there are really important things that we're talking about, and you keep asking me about this completely unimportant stuff.
Yes, exactly. Because what I want to really say is, you know, let me be clear, and it's quite important that what we need to talk about is this. Yes,
never
rather than
answering.
Exactly, and also shifting the blame and saying that's the problem with the BBC today. They don't ask the important questions. Well, they do, which is, yeah, all that stuff that you said 4 years ago, was it true, or did you just make it up in order to win votes? Because I suspect you're doing that right now, which he was. Yeah. You know, he was doing the same Gish Gallopy stuff. Okay, so that was just that's part one and 1A and 1B. For a bonus, the second example is this is James O'Brien on LBC Radio, which is London radio talk radio station. He's interviewing Jacob Rees-Mogg on the 20th of January this year. I've read a brilliant description of Jacob Rees-Mogg as an 18th century Nazi Charles Hawtrey, except we then have to explain to the US who Charles Hawtrey was, what the 18th century was, and that Nazis are bad. So that was quite amazing. Jacob Rees-Mogg belongs to the right wing of the Tory party. He runs what's called the European Research Group, which is neither European, doesn't conduct much research, and isn't really a group. And but they're just the kind of right wing no deal Brexiteers who I suspect there's a bit of bandwagon jumping going on in order to, you know, just maneuver into power and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, James O'Brien, who is a left-wing skeptic, shall we say, when it comes to the whole Brexit nonsense. He's quite, he's been described as a Jedi master when it comes to playing mind games on people that call in. He's very, very good at listening to what people say and saying it back to them almost as soon as they've said it. So here he is. He's trying to establish what Rees-Mogg sees as the good things about a no-deal Brexit, I guess beyond his own personal gains.
What can you see that all of the people who warn against coming out with no-deal can't see?
I can see what they've got wrong before and why.
I'm not asking about the past. I'm asking about the future. What can you see that they can't see?
The past is a very useful guide to the future because you can see why people are making the judgments. The CBI protects incumbent interests and therefore it always goes for things that are not for the consumer interest but the producer interest.
Yes, okay.
The governor of the Bank of England is a deeply politicised figure who has been anti-Brexit from the moment it was proposed. What can I see? I can see the opportunities of cheaper food, clothing and footwear, helping most of all the incomes of the least well-off in our
absolutely
society.
Absolutely nobody agrees with you.
We can cut tariffs. We can
absolutely
reduce costs
nobody
to people.
Agrees with you. Even
more competitive, more
even
open,
the Sun newspaper
economy.
Withdrew
it's
these claims.
Exciting. It's a
it's
great opportunity.
Exciting.
It is
it's
freedom
a great opportunity.
For the British people. It is no longer
freedom.
Shackled to the failed economic model of the European Union, which has the euro and high unemployment and even Germany going into recession. It is a wonderful opportunity for our nation. You should rejoice and be proud at what our country can do.
I was hoping to have reasons for rejoicing at the end of this conversation.
There you go. That, for me, is the quintessence of a Gish Gallop. It's a whole list of barely true, thoroughly compelling, noble-sounding statements.
Yeah. And if he's tried to go into
and
detail
said
why
in a,
each one was not true, it
yeah,
would take such
and O'Brien's trying to counter it by saying nobody agrees with you, you know, which is shortcut for all of the experts that have looked at this and they all disagree. Even the inexpert rabble rousing right wing newspaper The Sun has withdrawn its support for any of those statements. So, you know, it's a perfectly valid question. What is it that you can see that these people have, you know, all disagreed with? Where is your expertise coming from? And it doesn't come from anywhere except a kind of a rather plummy Victorian stovepipe hatted way of saying just a bunch of things that sound fairly aspirational and noble and wonderful and something to rejoice. You know, nobody uses the word rejoice, you know. It goes, what? And it's just, and it really is the only way to listen to Rees-Mogg.
If you don't, Americans who don't know what Jacob Rees-Mogg looks like, whatever you were picturing when you heard his voice.
19th century Nazi Charles Horton.
That's what he looks like.
Yeah, that's exactly what he looks like, yeah. There he is, Noel Gallagher.
Yeah.
Live from the Isle of Wight, singing Fallacy in the Wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, a bit of Pachelbel's Canon in there. If you listen to Pachelbel's Canon, you kind of go, oh, that's Canon in D minor. It's the same on Oasis. He stole it all.
Excellent. So In the Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about a fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective, and we're not getting super far from politics in the first example, because it's about climate change. The Gish Gallop works really well when you are trying to convince people of something that you have very little evidence for, because you can just say things that aren't evidence-based, but say a lot of them. And so this example is from a guy called Mark Morano, who was the communications director for Senator James Inhofe, who is the guy who brought a snowball onto the Senate floor to prove that global warming wasn't real, because snowballs exist. And Mark Morano is a climate change skeptic. He was on a program where they had a young person who believes in climate change essentially kind of trying to debate against people who don't believe in climate change. And he said this.
And I'm talking from the Arctic, which is now 9,000 Manhattans over the low point of 2007. Sea level, which contrary to predictions of it accelerating, has actually dropped, an historic drop, according to the European Space Agency and NASA. Polar bears at or near historic population high. Global temperatures that hit their high point in 1998. Claims of 2005, 2010 being the hottest years are based on hundreds of a degree Fahrenheit. It's a political statement. You can't even get a margin of error to even approach what they're claiming. 111 countries, Gallup did a survey. The majority of the human race isn't afraid of global warming.
That was a lot.
Wow.
A lot to unpack
there.
That was
great. You can't even get a margin of error to even approach that.
Yeah. So,
wow.
That was 32 seconds of climate change denial, in which he managed to fit in about 7 or 8 claims.
Yeah.
None of which are, well, let's say entirely accurate. There are things in there which are taken out of context. There's cherry picking.
Yeah.
There is, and as I mentioned earlier on, you know, this often incorporates a lot of different kinds of fallacies. Right at the end there was an argument from popularity saying that most people aren't afraid of global warming, which has nothing at all to do with whether global warming
to do with whether it exists or not. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
you know, tigers exist and yet most people aren't afraid of them because they don't exist near us.
So,
but that doesn't mean they don't exist.
This was in an Australian TV program, and Australian Guardian journalist Graham Redfern did a blog debunking all of the claims in this video. It took 32 seconds to say all those claims, but it took Graham Redfern about 1,000 words and about 4 or 5 charts to debunk them. And actually, he did it pretty quickly. He didn't go into a lot of detail on any of them. And I will link his blog post about this in the show notes at fallacioustrump.com/FT28. And you can see what Redfern has to say about this. Also, we mentioned that part of this tactic is that you can't cover everything, and if you miss something, then the person can basically claim victory. Mm. And even in the blog post covering this, Redfern talks about the Arctic sea ice, the sea level rises, what you mentioned about the
hundreds of a degree, you know, you can't even get a margin of error to get anywhere near that.
Yeah, but even in the blog post specifically debunking this video, he missed one. He missed the thing about polar bears.
No.
Because it's really hard to kind of do everything in there. And the polar bears thing is wrong too. Even at the time, this was in 2011, there were 19 distinct populations of polar bears in Canada and the Arctic. Yeah. And they knew that there was a couple that were increasing. And that's what he's saying, is that the polar bear populations are increasing. Right. There were two that were increasing in numbers of polar bears. There were two that were decreasing. But the vast majority, they didn't have numbers on. They don't. They kind of know they're there and where they are roughly, and roughly how many there are. But they're not tracking whether it's going up or down.
Yeah.
So it's not true to say polar bear numbers generally increasing. They were still at that time and are still heading for the endangered list. There are estimates that by 2050, the population of polar bears will be down by 30%. So again, that's not true. That didn't even make it into the blog post specifically debunking this video.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, again, this is an example of needing a lot of research. And Mark Morano is not a climate scientist. He's a communications director. He's a lobbyist. He's not an expert in this. He has talking points and he repeats them. And he knows, he must know that these are not true or not accurately portraying the real situation, because he's specifically choosing a part of a graph where it goes in one direction as opposed to in the general trend of the graph. And if you're not a climate scientist and if you're not someone who knows about this stuff, it's hard to debunk. You have to do some research. Our last example is to explain why it's called a Gish Gallop.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Because we haven't really addressed that. And it's because of a specific creationist called Dwayne Gish, who used to do a lot of debates. He died a few years ago, but he was in something like 300 debates with evolutionary biologists about evolution versus creationism. And he was an extremely prolific user of the Pratt technique of just, he had the same arguments he made again and again, and it didn't matter how many times he was proven wrong to his face, he would just say the same arguments again in the next debate. Because, again, it was about the number of arguments that he could get out. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this one, but I will link in the show notes a transcript of a debate that he had against a evolutionary biologist called Ken Saladin. And it was a 45-minute opening statement that Gish made, and he uses arguments from ignorance, from personal incredulity, from authority. Mm-hmm. He uses post hoc ergo propter hoc. He uses just so many different fallacies, and he makes so many claims. I was originally, when I kind of looked at this transcript, going to just kind of make a list of the biggest mistakes and things like that and say them, but it was too overwhelming, the number of things that he talks about. So check out the show notes, fallacioustrump.com/FT28, and you can see a link to an example of a debate by Dwayne Gish. There are others on YouTube you can look at. And the reason I haven't got a clip is that this is a 45-minute statement that he makes, and that there isn't a kind of a 1 minute thing where he says five or six different arguments, but he does transition from, among the things he does is talking
the many,
about the origin of the universe and claiming that evolution doesn't explain that. It's not designed to explain that. It's about how one species turns into another species. It's quite an education to watch Dwayne Gish. He's a really good debater. He was good at refuting things that other people said and pointing out flaws, but a lot of what he said wasn't actually backed up by evidence, and in a lot of cases was directly refuted, and he didn't care. He just kept saying it.
How about that? Having a fallacy named after you. That's really cool, isn't it?
So before we move on to fake news this week, I just want to address a little bit of feedback that we had. For our last episode, we had actually quite a lot of feedback with email and on Twitter and on Facebook. And thank you so much, everyone who got in touch with us.
Yeah.
Please keep doing that. Please keep getting in touch. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And a couple of people questioned one thing that I said about Bernie Sanders in our breakdown of the Democratic candidates. I said that Bernie did not endorse Hillary Clinton, and that is one of the reasons that I feel less encouraged by him this time round. And I think that a Democratic candidate who got to that stage of the last two would have done more rather than an independent candidate like Bernie. A couple of people said, actually, look, here's evidence that Bernie Sanders did endorse Hillary Clinton, and they linked to articles from July 2016, and that's brilliant. Please tell us if we say something wrong. That's great. We want to know. But I would point out that those articles were from July 12th. He did endorse Hillary Clinton at that point, but Hillary got the Democratic nomination on June 6th. So for five more weeks after that, when she was the presumptive Democratic candidate, he continued to campaign against her, to criticize her, to tell his followers not to support her before he eventually said, okay, we have to join together to beat Trump.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of damage during that period that meant that some of his supporters did not follow her and either
possibly more than Trump. Comey himself. Yeah.
So I was wrong when I said that Bernie didn't endorse Hillary, but I stand by the fact that his continued running against her and criticism of her did serious damage to her campaign. So,
yeah.
But thank you for pointing it out to me, and please continue to do that.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Yeah, and I'm currently running at 10 out of 26.
You are. And that's another thing I got wrong last time is I said you were at 40% because I thought it was 10 out of 25, but you're actually...
That's why you can't be trusted at all, because you can't add up. The BBC are out to get us. The Earth is flat. And just generally the Illuminati are running everything.
Yeah, so I'm not going to address any of those points. I'm just going to move straight on. The theme this week is about polls, because it's recently come out that Trump fired pollsters who pointed out
he didn't like the numbers
polls.
Yeah,
he didn't like their internal polling that said that Biden was going to beat Trump or could beat Trump, so he got rid of the pollsters.
Yeah.
So, statement number one. We have one poll where the pollster said, anybody that says, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to tell you, I don't want to even discuss it. And they also added another two words when they call up and they'd say these two horrible words. Anybody in that category, it's 100% vote for Trump. And what they've done is they don't count that, but now this one counts that. It's 100%. Statement number two.
Okay, right.
We do very little polling because I'm not a huge believer in polling. I think you go out there and you fight and you don't really need polls. You need ideas more than polls, but we have some internal polling, very little, and it's unbelievably strong. The strongest I've ever been is exactly today.
Well, even though I don't believe in them, they're unbelievably strong.
Number three. Yeah. We're doing tremendously in the polls. Okay. We're seeing numbers like never before, especially among Hispanics. And what they say, what the pollsters say, is that with Trump and polls, whatever the number is, you can add 20, because for whatever reason, people are ashamed to admit how much they love me. It's true.
And that's what there you go. There he just puts it's true on the end, and then that makes it true. Yeah, that first one, where the pollster said, anybody says I don't want to talk to you, they put that down 100% vote. There was one vote allegedly, or was it true in the Brexit vote, in the European vote recently for the MEPs, where somebody put bollocks, 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 not bollocks, and then not bollocks was counted as a vote for that party rather than a spoiled vote for the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we have a one pulse where they said, anybody said that, see, that's just completely so messed up. It's too damn true for words, isn't it? We're doing tremendous in the polls. We're doing very little polls. I'm not a huge believer. See, that one looks like it's very cleverly written because he does the believe and then the unbelievably. You can add 20 because whatever reason people show. Okay, I think, that one about Hispanics, I can recall him saying something about Hispanics early on. Okay, I think number three is the one you made up.
Okay, so which of the other two do you think you're more confident about?
I'm more confident about number one, mainly because I want to hear it.
Yeah. So number one is
is
real.
But we have one poll the pollster said, anybody that says, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to tell you, I don't want to even discuss it. And they also added another two words when they call up and they say these two horrible words. Anybody in that category, it's 100% vote for Trump. And what they've done is they don't count that. But now this one counts that. It's 100%.
What the hell is he even talking about?
Is that, that they call these people up to get who they're going to vote for. And if people say, fuck off, I don't want to talk to you. Previously, they don't write that down as a vote for Trump because it's not.
Because it isn't. Yeah. It's just somebody saying, I'm not even going to talk to you about it.
But there's one poll, which is the kind of internal polling he likes. They're counting that. If people tell them to fuck off, they're counting that as a vote for Trump.
Yeah. But there's two horrible words. I think one of those isn't off.
Presumably.
Off isn't horrible, is it?
In context.
It's just functional. Just going, yeah, I guess so, yeah. And so is he happy about that? Is he happy revealing that?
He seems
fine. He just can't keep anything a secret, can he? He's going, yeah, it's great. You see, before, when we weren't allowed to count the people that said, don't count my vote, we weren't allowed to do that. But now we count those, and do you know what? We've got loads more.
If you count people who haven't said they're going to vote for me.
Loads of people say they're going to vote for me. Yeah. All the people that say, I don't want to vote for you, I don't even want to talk to you about voting, we've counted those as a vote for me because fundamentally that's what I'm doing for people.
So
I'm empowering the people that are unhappy about the voting system.
So you also think number two on earth? is real?
Yeah.
Number two?
Not confident. Yeah.
Is? Real.
Yeah.
We do very little polling because I'm not a huge believer in polling. I think you go out there and you fight and you don't really need polls. You need ideas more than polls. But we have some internal polling, very little, and it's unbelievably strong. The strongest I've ever been is exactly today.
I nearly didn't think that was real because it's too good of a setup, isn't it? So I'm not a huge believer. I don't believe in that. You need ideas more than polls, but we do have some.
We do have some, and it's brilliant.
And do you know what? It's really
polling
really
that
good.
I believe in.
It's brilliant.
Shows that I'm brilliant.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, because I don't believe it. But how old is that?
That's actually really recent.
Ideas more
that
than
is
really
that is in the last two, three weeks. Yeah.
He's just so naive, and he hasn't actually. It's not. I wanted to, the two words I wanted to use: advanced or developed.
No.
They're not even coming out of my mouth. It just hasn't progressed. No, nothing evolved. Nothing is working. Over the 3 years he's been in, nothing has changed.
Which means that you're on a roll.
Oh,
you are.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, you've won again. I think this is possibly three or four in a row.
Oh, my God. It can't last.
You are now on 11 out of 27, which is, if my math is right, over 40%.
Yeah. Wow.
So.
And did you write the third one?
That was all me.
Guest appearance.
Yeah, so.
It was good.
It's not good enough, obviously.
No, it was the little it's true on the end, I think. Powers are fading. Yeah, so we won't put the appeal out, but, you know, if you fancy your chances, bring it on. Bring it on. I can spot them a mile off. Yeah. Not up close, but a mile away. Yeah.
So it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Katie Porter is Not a Logical Fallacy.
Yay!
We talked a few episodes ago about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and it's time to talk about one of her fellow freshman congresswomen, the representative for the California 45th District, Katie Porter, who is just awesome. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
The reason that we're talking about her this week is because she has just come out in favor of impeachment, basically partly, I think, based on having actually read the Mueller report. And
Has Nancy Pelosi read it?
And I think the interesting thing is that Katie Porter is in a district which was traditionally Republican. It's been fairly staunchly
up until
Trump, basically, and they kind of got a bit more interested in Democrats. And Katie Porter won her district by 4 points in 2016. So she is she's one of the Congress people in a less safe district. And Justin Amash, the Republican guy who is almost certainly going to lose his seat in the next election because he's in favor of impeachment. But, you know, he has some integrity and thinks that it's more important to talk about impeachment rather than just save his job. Katie Porter is talking about impeachment despite potentially that putting her in an unsafe position in a traditional Republican district. So I think, and some people are saying, many people are saying that one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi is not in favor of impeachment and hasn't been pushing it has been out of concern for people like Katie Porter, Democrats who are in potentially unsafe districts and fear that they will lose their seats, basically, and therefore possibly lose the House and negative things happening while there's no real possibility of the Senate convicting Trump. So with people like Katie Porter and people in those areas and more Democrats coming out in favor of impeachment, I think it might be the way to push Pelosi more towards agreeing and going down that route. But getting back to Katie Porter, she's, as I said, freshman congresswoman, and she is a law professor. She studied under Elizabeth Warren. She is a consumer rights advocate, and she is really impressive in congressional hearings when she is questioning people. They have to have done their research, otherwise they're going to be made to look stupid. And and particularly if they are pretty stupid, like probably the world's stupidest brain surgeon, Ben Carson, who well, I've got a clip. She asked him, and you've almost certainly heard or seen this before, but she asked him about REOs, which are real estate owned properties. And he didn't quite know what she was talking about. And he is the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
I'd also like you to get back to me, if you don't mind, to explain the disparity in REO rates. Do you know what an REO is?
An Oreo?
No, not an Oreo. An REO. REO.
Real estate?
What's the O stand for?
E-organization?
Owned. Real estate owned. That's what happens when a property goes to foreclosure. We call it an REO.
Fantastic. Yes, it's real estate.
Oh, God.
And you're the in charge of the thing.
It's amazing. One of her things is when there is a congressional hearing, she will actually question the person who's under examination, basically under questioning, to find out if they know anything about what they're supposed to be talking about. Rather than just specifically questioning them about what the purpose of the hearing is, she kind of does the background and does the research for herself so that she knows what she's talking about. And a lot of this is from her consumer advocacy and law work that she already knows this stuff.
Yeah.
But she will question them to find out whether their level of expertise is sufficient to actually be doing the job and to be answering the questions that they're supposed to be answering. And she repeatedly uncovers people who really shouldn't be there, like Ben Carson, who hasn't... he's been in that job for a while and he hasn't taken the time to really learn anything about, because that's, REO isn't that obscure a thing.
It's certainly not in the consumer rights world. It happens all the time.
It's reasonably well known and he should know about it. And
particularly if you're in charge of the bloody thing.
And when she was questioning Kathy Craninger, the director of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, whose job it is to make sure that consumers understand financial products and protect them to make sure that they are being sold to accurately, she went a little bit beyond the questioning that the person was expecting.
Could you please explain to this committee the difference between an interest rate and an APR?
So the APR is the extrapolation if it were a one-year term in terms of the loan. So that's the calculation that is laid out in TILA in particular.
So if I take the stated interest rate and do the math to deal with the fact that it's annualized, the APR, I would be correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Craninger, the annual percentage rate, and I'll be happy to send you a copy of the textbook that I wrote, explains that the APR is derived from the finance charge, the amount financed, and the payment schedule. It's a mathematical transformation of those three numbers into the cost of credit expressed at a yearly rate.
Simplification, I understand, that you know well.
Well, my concern is whether you know well, ma'am, because you are the one responsible for making sure that American consumers know well when they take on loans.
That is so brilliant.
Fantastic, isn't it? When you just go, yeah, wait a minute, I wrote the manual. Yeah. I wrote the textbook. Let me just quote you from the textbook, which I wrote. That is so good, isn't it?
It is absolutely
that's
perfect.
That's like being a superhero, isn't it?
And in this...
Who just go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, in this question...
How often is that like... Oh, how long has she been waiting
for
that?
Absolutely the holy grail. That's just brilliant. For an academic to be able to do that. That's great. So, but yeah, in this questioning, she asked Kreninger to ballpark the APR on a particular kind of loan. She gave her very basic details, mm-hmm. like 10% loan, $100 loan, two weeks, what's the APR? And she could not even come close to having a guess at it. And the problem is that's what consumers are being asked to do when they are trying to compare different rates to see whether a particular loan is cheaper than another loan. And the people at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are supposed to be making sure that that is possible for consumers.
Yeah.
Supposed to be helped.
And,
you know,
and that they're protected in those transactions. Yeah. The stuff is made completely obvious and clear, or that they point out when it's being deliberately obscured in order to make it hard for the consumer to make an informed decision. And if they can't do it themselves, then what's the point of them being in office? Well, that's fundamentally the question, isn't it? Being posed by the Democrats. That's the unspoken question, isn't it?
So we love Katie Porter. She's brilliant. She is really intelligent and does her research, and anyone who's going up against her should do their research so that they don't look like idiots.
And is not afraid to ask those questions of people who have been resting on their laurels, trading on their position in authority, you know, appealing to their own authority.
Despite having no expertise in the field. Yeah.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
The Office of Special Counsel, an independent government agency that oversees the behaviour of federal employees, has recommended that Kellyanne Conway be immediately fired for, quote, egregious, notorious and ongoing, end quote, violations of the Hatch Act, a statute that prohibits federal employees from taking part in political campaigns while on duty, like the time Kellyanne told people in her official capacity as counsellor to the president to vote for accused paedophile Roy Moore, or the literally dozens of other times she did something similar. She doesn't seem too worried, telling one journalist, blah, 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 tell me when the jail sentence starts. Of course she's not worried. Trump isn't going to do anything about it because in his administration, breaking the law isn't a bug, it's a feature.
In a move absolutely guaranteed to cast the last shred of doubt that he could possibly be capable of collusion from the minds of, well, just about everyone, Trump told ABC News that if he was offered dirt on his 2020 opponent, I'd want to hear it, adding that he'd probably only tell the FBI, quote, if I thought there was something wrong, unquote. Well, just like the last time, I guess. Yeah, remind me how that's working out for you again, Donnie.
On Flag Day, the official White House Twitter account deliberately tweeted a picture of Trump dry-humping the American flag at CPAC like a fucking maniac. For some reason, they thought it was a good thing that the president thinks that's what patriotism looks like. Weirdly, some people think the flag should be treated with a bit more respect, but after all, when you're a star, the flag lets you do it.
Yeah, you can just grab it by the pole. In more echoes of Back to the Future, this time where Marty parks the DeLorean behind the sign for Lyons Estates, and there's no estate, Trump Heights was announced in Israel. But there's no heights, just a bit of scenery, some artificial grass, and some pomp, but no circumstance. As even the founder of the Knesset Caucus for the Golan, Kahol Levan Mukzvi Hauser, observed, anyone who reads the fine print of the historic decision understands that this is a conceptual decision. There is no funding, there is no planning, there is no location, and there really is no committed decision. Netanyahu's government has made a brilliant move. After all, what does Trump love more than seeing his name in golden letters on a big sign? The main thing is the picture. Who's going to check afterwards whether a community is built there or not? The honour has already been bestowed. The facts are marginal.
It's a fantastic metaphor for the Trump presidency, isn't it?
It's brilliant.
It is. It's just Trump's naming lights. No planning, no funding, no committed decision.
No. And just by a foreign dictator, mainly, you know, somebody who wants to stamp out a race of other people.
In fact, just, even have any power because he's not got a government.
No, because he's in a temporary government. Exactly.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's not even a... It's just a temporary decision. It's a temporary decision not to do anything.
Last week in the Gulf of Oman, two Japanese tankers were attacked, and Mike Pompeo, who really, really seems to want to go to war with Iran, says Iran did it with underwater limpet mines, and they totally have evidence, but they aren't going to show you because reasons. Unfortunately for Mike, the owner of one of the tankers says the crew saw a projectile flying towards the ship before the explosion, and the damage is all well above the waterline. But that's just crazy. I mean, the US government would not lie about a foreign aggressor to justify going to war. Oh, wait.
Right, so here's the thing. You're making a film about a spy in the White House, and it turns out that, no, it was the president all along. Well, what a damn great plot twist that would be. Yeah, forget it. It's been done. A report in the New York Times says top people in the US military and Trump's own government are attempting to evade filling Trump in on the details of an anti-Russian espionage effort because of an informed suspicion that Donald Trump might well sabotage their efforts on behalf of their Russian targets. Okay, what that actually is that they are behaving with at least some consideration that Trump, as president, may either be acting as foreign agent or is simply so incapable of restraint that he could expose intelligence details he's been given in order to ingratiate himself with or merely make small talk with foreign visitors / dictators. That's what you get, you see, when you call your lead character after the British slang for noise that comes out of an arse. I, for one, wouldn't greenlight that movie. Not realistic enough.
Evangelical Trump supporters are about to get a lesson in the law of unintended consequences. Trump's latest proposed tariffs on China include 25% or more on printed material. Fun fact, the overwhelming majority of Bibles in the US are printed in China. And according to a spokesman from publishers HarperCollins, due to the unique paper printing and binding needs of Bible production, there are simply no US vendors that could produce any significant portion of the volume needed to meet demands of the US market, adding that a 25% tariff could result in a Bible shortage. It looks like people are going to have to not read something else instead.
This week in the UK, we were treated to the return of the spectacle of government as described by the Situationists in 1960s revolutionary Paris through televised debates between Tory leadership hopefuls vying to appear the most socialist. Us poor gawping souls in the TV audience have no actual say over who gets to go through to the next round. That's down to other MPs. And we don't even get to vote on the final choice. This is the very opposite of Love Island. As at James Melville accurately tweeted, Britain is a country where a new prime minister will be chosen by 0.3% of the electorate to form a government that doesn't have a majority in a party that's at 20% in the polls to try and deliver something that most of the country doesn't want.
So, that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this episode. You can find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com, and if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/ftrump.
You can also connect with us and other listeners at the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump. And also, the Merseyside Skeptics Society, run by friend of the show Michael Marshall, are having a 10th anniversary event in Liverpool on July 6th. Mark and I will be there. So if you're in the area, fancy a day of skeptical fun, go to msx.co.uk to get tickets and come and say hi.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this episode. If you can find... Now, why do I say if you can every time? You can find the show notes.
If you can find them, good luck to you.